I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. A flood, a surge, an influx. In 2014, headline writers struggled to convey the massive number of Central American children crossing the border into the United States. Those headlines have faded, but the kids are still coming. In fact, we are likely on the cusp of a new, equally large wave of unaccompanied minors from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. As in the previous surge, many of these children are coming to Maryland. Today we'll talk with Randy Capps, an expert from the Migration Policy Institute, a nonprofit think tank, and Alejandra Morisi, staff attorney for Catholic Charities Esperanza Center in Baltimore. What happens to unaccompanied child migrants once they arrive? It's midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you are with us today. More and more Central American children are crossing the border into the United States without a legal guardian. Some travel in large groups with as many as 50 other minors. Some come alone. In 2014, Border Patrol apprehended nearly 70,000 unaccompanied children. Judging from the lack of headlines, you might think the flood had died down, and it did, briefly. But over the last few months, a new surge has begun. Maryland is receiving a disproportionate number of these kids. Montgomery County and Prince George's County have some of the largest concentrations of unaccompanied child migrants in the country, and many have also come to Baltimore County and Baltimore City. More than 6,000 migrant children have been released in Maryland since late 2013, according to the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR. To give us a better picture of all this, Randy Capps joins us on the line from Washington. Randy Capps is Director of Research for U.S. Programs at the Migration Policy Institute, a nonprofit think tank. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila.
Hold on a minute. I need to get my level a little higher. And with me here in the studio is Alejandra Morisi, a staff attorney for Catholic Charities Esperanza Center in Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Very glad that you're here. Randy, it seems we're seeing an upsurge in unaccompanied child migrants. Do we know what's causing them to come in greater numbers again?
Yeah, the conditions in the Central American countries that are sending the child migrants, that's El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, the three countries immediately south of Mexico, those conditions haven't changed in the last few years. If anything, they're getting worse. The murder rate has been going up, particularly in El Salvador. But there's a lot of violence in the other two countries as well. And there's a really severe drought in Guatemala and Honduras that's increasing the poverty rate in those two countries.
So I guess maybe the question that I should have asked you is, why did the numbers of unaccompanied children go down last year after surging in 2014?
Yeah, we're not entirely sure why. Part of the reason is because Mexico started deporting more people. They beefed up their southern border with Guatemala. They arrested more people who were traveling across Mexico to come to the U.S. and deported some of them. It may be because there was an immediate rush to the United States in 2014. A lot of people got through, and then that rush kind of petered out. Or it may be that for a short while it looked like the U.S. wasn't going to be as hospitable towards the new migrant children and families, and now it looks like maybe the U.S. is going to be more hospitable again. So a number of things change over the last couple of years.
Yeah, remind me to ask you later about this change in the hospitality signal that the U.S. is sending, but I want to ask Alejandra Morisi. You work with these kids. What kind of stories are these kids telling you about why they left their homes?
So most of these children are escaping some very severe gang violence. And the reason why the children in particular are coming over here and as opposed to adults is because the gangs are targeting the children for recruitment. So they're trying to grow their gangs, and they're also, that's the primary reason, but another reason is that they're trying to get the children to commit illegal acts for them. So they're put in a position in which they are threatened to, like, they're threatening their lives or their family's lives, and their other choice is to commit an illegal act or to join a gang.
So tell me, I mean, is this something that they think might happen, or is this something that they've actually experienced?
No, this is something that happens, and they see it. They're threatened, so they receive verbal threats. They receive written threats. They have friends who were killed for not joining the gang when they were recruited. They are constantly being assaulted by gangs. And it's the same thing with the girls. It's a little bit different with girls. They're like being recruited as girlfriends. And there's also a lot of gender violence when it comes
to the girls.
They're
being recruited as girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what that means.
Well, I guess recruited is kind of sounds like there's some will in it. But a lot of the girls feel forced to become a girlfriend either for protecting their own family. They will say that they just, you know, I scope them out like in the schools or something, and they'll say, hey, I like her. I want her to be my girlfriend. And then it's just seen like you will be my girlfriend. They just come up to you and they say, I want you to be my girlfriend. And if you don't, you know, we're going to come after you, or we'll come after your family. We know where you live. We know where your father's business is, et cetera.
So, you mentioned Alejandra coming after families.
Yes.
So what happens when these children leave? What happens to their families?
Well, a lot of the families do get affected by it. Some of the children, I think, are hoping that as soon as they leave, the threat diminishes around their family. And I think it does for the most part. But I do have children who they flee over here, and then when they're here, they will kill a father, or they will kill like their brother. And so that is actually like a very common scenario.
Oh my. Randy Capps, why are these kids coming alone?
A lot of them actually have a parent already here of those kids that go through the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And are reunified, about half of them are reunified, more than half of them are reunified with a parent. And they're able to find a placement with a relative or a close family friend with about 85% of the children that go through Office of Refugee Resettlement. So they often what happened is that their parents came in an earlier wave and came up here to work and establish themselves and left these children behind when they were younger. And when the children get older, they come up to join their families because of the threats that Alejandra mentioned.
And I'm certainly not trying to minimize the threats. You've heard them firsthand, and I haven't, both of you. But what you just laid out, Randy Capp, sounds to me almost as if it was kind of always in the cards that once the parents felt they had a foothold in the U.S. economy, that they would send for the kids.
I mean, I don't think it would have necessarily been in the cards if there were jobs in these countries, if the environment were safe, if these children could stay in school and go to college the way that children do in the U.S. and increasingly in Mexico, if they had futures that were safe and potentially prosperous in those countries, they might have stayed there. But that's not the case.
What exactly does it mean? Let me ask you, Alejandra, what exactly does it mean to be unaccompanied?
When the children are coming into the United States, that's a categorization that CBP, that immigration, places on the children. If they are under 18 and they are not in the company of somebody who has legal custody or legal guardianship over them, then they will be considered an unaccompanied child, and they go through a different route. They're treated differently by the immigration system, so they're not detained in the same way that an adult is detained.
Yeah, Randy Capps, let me ask you about that. What happens after an unaccompanied child is met by Border Patrol at the border?
Yeah, and I think one of the important things to remember is that the first step, you know, these children almost all come across the Rio Grande River in South Texas on a boat or sometimes on an inner tube, and they surrender themselves to the Border Patrol. It's not like the adults around the border that the Border Patrol have to find and apprehend. Most of these children surrender themselves. And then they can stay in Border Patrol custody for up to 72 hours. And after that, then they're placed into the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which then has a period that's usually around a month before they try to find a relative or someone else who can take them into their home.
And from the feedback you get, does that schedule work in most cases that young people are only in the custody of Border Patrol for, what, 3 days, and they end up in an ORR facility, a federal resettlement facility, for longer while their relatives or someone who can legally take custody is found? Does that schedule actually work?
From what I understand, it's worked fairly well in the Border Patrol end, although I think there were problems in 2014 at the height of the surge simply because ORR didn't have the capacity to move people out of Border Patrol custody quickly enough. But I think that generally the Border Patrol processing is very fast, and they've done a lot to try to streamline that. The Office of Refugee Resettlement has a much more difficult task. They have to screen all these children for trafficking, for mental health issues, for real potential, you know, long-term fears. They have to help assess their physical health and all that. Then they have to find the sponsors. They have to vet the sponsors, make sure that the sponsors, even if their parents or relatives aren't somehow in cahoots with the traffickers, they have to find a safe place for them. So there's a lot that ORR has to do during that period. And, of course, the more that children coming in to the ORR system at any one time, the faster they have to get them out so that they have enough space for them in their system.
That is Randy Capps, Director of Research for U.S. Programs at the Migration Policy Institute, a nonprofit think tank in Washington. Here on Midday on WYPR, I'm Sheila Kasten. With me here in the studio is Alejandra Morisi, staff attorney for Catholic Charities Esperanza Center in Baltimore. She works exclusively with unaccompanied children. You can be part of this conversation, too. What do you think when you hear that the headlines that we heard in 2014 of so many young people streaming across the southern border of the U.S., that's ramping up again? Do you have some ideas about what the U.S. should be doing about it? You can give us a call. Our toll-free number from all around Maryland is 1-866-661-9309. And our local number around Baltimore is 410-662-8780. Or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Randy, I want to pick up on you're talking about making sure that traffickers don't get involved. As you know, an investigative subcommittee of the U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee reported last week that U.S. agencies unknowingly handed some of these unaccompanied children over to human traffickers. In one case, at least six kids ended up on an egg farm in Ohio where they were forced to work under threat of death, living in squalid conditions. Here is Senator Claire McCaskill reacting to the report at a hearing, Senate hearing last week.
Nothing breaks my heart more than the notion that these parents and their children facing unspeakable problems in their home countries took a risk that every parent in this room can't even imagine taking. They said, yeah, take my child. I want this child out of this country because I love this child so much. And they believed America was someplace that they would be safe and maybe have a future. And we have two federal agencies that have abdicated their responsibility for the welfare of these children.
The two federal departments Senator McCaskill is referring to are the Departments of Health and Human Services and Homeland Security. Randy Capps, let me ask you the same question that was asked at that Senate hearing. How does something like this happen?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the senator that it's absolutely heartbreaking that people could be migrate from a very dangerous situation into, you know, a possibly equally dangerous situation. The reality is extremely complex. In order to figure out if these placements are safe, the Office of Refugee Resettlement has to do background checks on everybody in the household that's an adult, and it turns out that they weren't always doing all those background checks. They should, if they were like a child welfare agency, do a home visit and actually go and inspect the location to make sure it's really where the children are going and that it's a safe place. And they don't have the resources to do that. And they should follow up. They should do, you know, follow-up phone calls and follow-up visits to make sure these kids are okay. The reality is they only have the staff and resources to do that through their contractors with a handful or a small percentage of the cases. So a lot of these cases fall through the cracks. And, yes, it's heartbreaking for the families, but the reality is that these families, in some cases, signed on with the traffickers. The Office of Refugee Resettlement called, and I think that was true in at least one of these egg farm cases, called the parents and said, is this person that's going to take custody of your child okay to take custody of them? And the parents said yes. Why? Because either their home was mortgaged to the traffickers or the traffickers had a gun to their head. So that same violence that's created that migration pressure from these countries is now coming through these migration channels through the traffickers. And so it takes a lot of extra effort for the federal government to adequately screen all these cases, and they just weren't able to do it when they had this wave of children coming in 2014.
And is the implication then that they may not be able to do it now, that there's a new surge?
Well, they'll have to do things differently. I mean, they've already said that they're going to do thorough background checks on all the adults in the household, which I think is really important. There's a lot of pressure from people working in the field that they should do home visits, at least for all the cases that aren't parents and immediate relatives, so they can see what the conditions look like and meet these potential sponsors face-to-face. And there's pressure to do more follow-up visits. The question is where the resource is going to come from to do that. But there are plenty of people like Alejandra with Catholic Charities and the other folks that have contracted to work with the UAC population, there are plenty of people with experience working with these children out there who are ready to provide these services. There just needs to be more leadership at the federal level to make it happen, and there are going to need to be more resources.
We need to take a short break here, and when we come back, we're going to hear more from our guests, and we hope from you. What questions do you have for Randy Capps of the Migration Policy Institute, and Alejandra Morisi of the Esperanza Center here in Baltimore? Have you encountered any of these young people in our communities? You can join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about unaccompanied children migrants from Central America. Over the last few months, a surge of new children has arrived, many of them coming to Maryland. We're talking to Alejandra Morisi, a staff attorney for Catholic Charities Esperanza Center here in Baltimore, and to Randy Capps, director of research for U.S. programs at the Migration Policy Institute, a think tank in Washington. If you have a question or comment about unaccompanied young people entering the U.S., entering Maryland, call us. Are you proud that Maryland is fifth among states in the number of kids being resettled, or does it worry you? Our toll-free number is 866-661-9309. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, and our local number here in Baltimore, close to Baltimore, is 410-662-8780. We'd love to hear from you. Alejandra Morisi, you were hired at the Esperanza Center in 2014 at the peak of the first surge. What difficulties have you encountered as a lawyer working exclusively with this population of unaccompanied migrants?
I think one of the biggest challenges is just trying to meet the need, having the resources to meet the number of children who need legal representation. We also... One of the most common forms of relief for children is called special immigrant juvenile status, and that is something that is somewhat dependent on the state court, and so that depends on your jurisdiction and where you are, and so that varies a lot also depending on where you are.
Okay, let me make sure I understand a couple things. When you say it's dependent on the state court, it is literally part of the state court system, or is it a federal court that is specialized for each state?
No, it's... Special immigrant juvenile status is for children whom a state court finds that were abused, abandoned, or neglected by one or both parents and whose deportation is not in the children's best interest. You can have that's a pathway to adjusting the status of the children.
So it's a pathway to citizenship?
Yes. It is. And that's the most common form of relief that most children are eligible for. And so what is interesting about that form of relief is that it has a federal aspect, and then we need what's called a predicate order from a state court that finds that the child was abused, abandoned, or neglected. And so in order to obtain that, then we have to go through a state court. And that sometimes is challenging depending on where you are.
It's challenging for me just to get my head around the idea of a state court in, say, Prince George's County, mm-hmm. making a determination about what happened to this child in El Salvador.
Yeah.
Sometimes. I mean, they probably wouldn't have witnesses from what happened. I mean, how does a state court make that determination?
Sometimes they do. Sometimes there are witnesses, and we provide like declarations, affidavits. There's pictures. There's reports. Sometimes, you know, if there's, for example, if there's a case in which there was sexual abuse and it was reported in home country, then we might have that report. And so we put a case just like you would put any case. You know, you have to have enough evidence. And you have to have a very thorough case to present to the judge. And so, yeah, but that I think that that's what some of the judges also struggle with. And a lot of them are uneasy about making a determination that will have an effect on somebody's immigration status. So it all depends on your jurisdiction and how much some judges know or how much they're familiar with special immigrant juvenile status. So that sometimes it's challenging just knowing where you are and the fact that that can change and that might affect who's eligible for special immigrant juvenile status and eventually to adjust their status.
And I gather from the name of it, special immigrant juvenile status, that this is a part of the law that's only available to people under what? Under 18? Under 21?
It's a humanitarian form of relief that's offered to children under 21 who are unmarried. That's on the federal level. That's immigration. In order to apply with immigration, the child must be under 21, unmarried, and they must have been abandoned, abused, or neglected by one or both parents. And so that reuniting with one of their parents is not viable. In order to obtain that order, we have to go to state court. And sometimes the state court, they only have jurisdictions with cases for minors, and how they define a minor can limit who obtains that order. Because even though immigration defines a child as somebody under 21, in your state, they might define a minor as somebody under 18. So you will be, if you live in certain states, you will only be eligible for special immigrant juvenile status if you're under 18.
That's Alejandra Morisi, staff attorney for Catholic Charities Esperanza Center here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us from Washington is Randy Capps from the Migration Policy Institute. Randy, can you overall give us a sense of where are these kids who have arrived, these close to 100,000, I guess, where they are in the court process?
Yeah, it's really important. I just want to start by saying it's really important that these kids get representation by lawyers like Alejandra, because it makes a huge difference in what happens with them. For the unaccompanied children, almost 90% of those that don't get representation wind up being ordered deported. And that doesn't mean they actually are deported. I'll get back to that in a minute.
So nine out of ten, if you don't have a lawyer...
Almost 9 out of 10, you're going to be ordered deported. If you are represented, only about 14% are ordered deported. So only between 1 and 2 out of 10.
Okay, so who gets a lawyer and who doesn't?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the availability of legal counsel. I don't know how, maybe Alejandra can tell you how the children come to her, but I think a lot of it's the roll of the dice.
Because the legal process does not provide a public defender if a child can't afford one. I mean, there's not a right to counsel.
Correct.
In this process.
Correct.
So how do kids come to you, Alejandra?
Most of the kids come to our center by word of mouth. We do have a reputation in our community for serving immigrants, and we have done a lot of cases already. So we get like people in their neighborhoods and, you know, or extended family members, and they come to us in that way. We also for our center, we have we're part of the reunification process where they do the fingerprints for the sponsors. So they're already aware of some processes and some legal relief available because that department tries to educate the community as well when they're trying to become ORR sponsors to get the kids out of the shelters. We are also listed on the referral list in court itself. So in immigration court here in Baltimore, we have some amazing, we're very fortunate, we have amazing immigration judges. And they do worry a lot that the kids are being protected and cared for and that they're receiving legal representation. So we're also on that list. And then we also receive referrals from the shelters. So the kids do...
The shelters, meaning the ORR?
Yes.
Office of Refugee Resettlement Shelters?
Yes. So the kids do, in many shelters, receive like Know Your Rights presentations, and they receive a list once they know that that child is going to be reuniting with a cousin or a parent or something in a particular state. They will give them a list of providers in that state.
So, Randy, you told us that if a child doesn't have a lawyer in the legal proceedings, it's quite likely, like 90% likely, that they'll end up being ordered to be deported. What if a child does have a lawyer? What are the odds?
Well, again, if they do have a lawyer, only 14% of them, for the latest data that we have been ordered deported yet. Now, a lot of those cases are still pending, so they're still going through the process, and they may be ordered deported later on. And those that do get relief often get what's called sort of an administrative relief or a temporary relief. It's not a permanent visa to stay in the U.S. yet. I mean, they might put in an application for the special immigrant status that Alejandra mentioned. They might qualify for a trafficking visa or a visa that's called a U visa, which is a victim of crime. But a lot of them... just get a deferral or a stay of deportation, and that doesn't mean that they're going to get to stay long term.
And you made the point a minute ago. You said you wanted to say more about it. That when we read the large numbers of deportation orders that are lodged, migrants, young migrants ordered to be deported, that doesn't necessarily mean they end up being deported.
That's correct, and actually only a few thousand so far actually have been deported. A fair number of them don't, especially those that are not represented. I think about 30% is the latest figures we have, don't show up for any of their court hearings. So they're ordered deported what's called in absentia, which means they weren't there to defend themselves, and so it's kind of automatic that they're put in deportation proceedings. But then, of course, they have often disappeared, and the authorities can't find them to deport them, or they don't go looking either. I mean, this is
the authorities don't go looking.
Yeah, well, this controversy. If you remember, the beginning of the year, the Obama administration sent some immigration teams to find some Central American families, about 100 of them or so. Mm-hmm. These were people who had final orders of deportation and didn't show up when they were supposed to be deported, and that. They got a lot of pushback from that for good reason because, you know, people were saying they're deporting families with children back to harm's way. People would say the same thing if they went door to door trying to find these children, young children, who hadn't shown up for their deportation hearing or who hadn't shown up at the time and place where they were supposed to get on the plane to be deported. That would cause a lot of backlash, too. So basically a lot of these orders, either they're issued when the child isn't in court, so the child doesn't, and the family don't know, and the sponsor don't know about it, or else they're just not enforced.
And you may have said this, and it didn't lodge with me, Randy. How many unaccompanied minors have someone like Alejandra to represent them? What proportion of this wave of young migrants have legal representation?
It's a little bit under half from the latest statistics that I've seen that actually have some kind of representation.
And Alejandra, am I right that you work on this full time, but there are also volunteer lawyers, pro bono lawyers who
yes.
take some cases?
Yes, we absolutely could not meet the demand if it wasn't with the help of our pro bono attorneys. So we have a large number. Like right now, I believe we have over 200 cases, and 85 of them are cases that pro bonos are involved with, and they get involved to different degrees, but they're just really trying to help us meet the demand because we cannot do that with just the staff that we have at the Esperanza Center.
And how do pro bonos lawyers get involved?
Well, we had a training a long time ago, so they can contact us and sign up through the website, and then they receive a training. Sometimes we do offer some in-person trainings, but we have like a webinar. And then after that, they will meet with us, and we create blurbs for the cases, and we support the pro bonos as much as they need in order to help us out with the cases. And yeah, and so we help them out. Some pro bonos already doing, let's say, for example, family law. So they're very familiar with the state court portion, and they'll say, hey, we'll do the family law part, and then you can do the immigration part. Or some of them are willing to take on the whole case, and they do that.
So you said they can contact you. They can go on your website.
Yes.
What is that? We'll find that. We'll find that, and we'll say it later in the show, and we will put it on our website also. Dave is calling us. I'm not sure from where. We're talking about unaccompanied minors. I'm not sure that's Dave's point, but Dave, do you have a comment about these young people coming from Central America to the United States?
Yes, Sheila, thanks for taking my call. And I just want to say thanks for the Esperanza Center's work. They do tremendous things. I've gone to Nicaragua about 12 times through a sister parish connection. And I just think it's very useful for listeners to get engaged either through an organization like Sister Parish or their various advocacy groups that try to work on economic justice issues in Central America, and a lot of the problems were caused in Salvador, the case of the Civil War in the 70s and 80s, and young people being forced to work and go to the army and fleeing Salvador, parents sending them to Los Angeles, and maybe not the infrastructure, support structure was not there for them, and they came back to Salvador and joined gangs. I mean, this is part of my understanding. There's a movie called Innocent Voices, which I totally recommend. Regarding Honduras, Enrique's Journey by Sonia Nazario talks about a young man who, I think he tried to make 8 attempts to come to the United States to be reunited with his mother and traveled like 12,000 miles before it finally happened. And just the psychological trauma that people, young people have undergone is just incredible. And the groups like I mentioned, Sister Parish, the Share Foundation, Guatemalan Human Rights Commission, Latin America Working Group, Rights Action, the organizations which look at what we can do here in our country with economic measures, immigration issues.
Dave, I appreciate the suggestions. Enrique's Journey is a film, correct?
I think it's a film. It's a book by Sonia Nazario, a writer for the Los Angeles Times and winner of a Pulitzer Prize.
I appreciate your suggestions, Dave. Thanks for calling. Alejandra, many of the kids who get here have, you talked about it earlier, some of the trauma that they have gone through. Are they getting counseling when they get to Maryland?
So some of the children, when they are in the shelter, in the Office of Refugee Resettlement Shelter, receive the help of a social worker, and some of them don't. But most of the children come here, and sometimes it depends on the school, sometimes it depends on the family structure. But I would say for the most part, no. We try. That is something that is very important to us at the Esperanza Center, and what I've seen really with the other attorneys who are working with unaccompanied children, we understand that therapy can be very beneficial for the children. It helps with compliance. It helps with their cases. And so we try to work with local organizations here also, because that's another thing that I think could really support the children. But that it's like, and just the demand is so great that the few organizations that are helping out are just overwhelmed.
We need to take another short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the impact these unaccompanied minors are having on schools. Do you work at a school that's seen a big influx of kids from Central America? Do you think they're getting the services they need? Does it seem fair to you that it's a local responsibility to provide schooling to these young migrants? Send an email to us, midday@wypr.org, or give us a call, 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone, and our conversation about children fleeing El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and what happens when these kids get to the U.S., especially when they get to Maryland. I'm Sheila Cast. You can be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm here with Alejandra Morisi, staff attorney for Catholic Charities Esperanza Center in Baltimore. We were talking earlier about how lawyers who want to get involved helping represent these young people can get involved. The Catholic Charities website, www.catholiccharities-maryland.md.org. Let me do that again. Catholic Charities, all one word, -md.org. If you go to that website, there'll be a link to take you specifically to information about pro bono volunteers. And on the line with us from Washington is Randy Capps from the Migration Policy Institute. So, Randy, it sounds as if these cases are moving very slowly through the courts. And since October, just in Prince George's County, nearly 500 of these unaccompanied minors have arrived. What kind of strain are these children putting on public schools?
Well, the schools have to deal with a number of issues. I mean, as Alejandra mentioned, there's not a lot of resources to provide counseling for them. They may or may not get very good mental health support while they're in ORR custody. And then they're arriving and being placed with families that often have limited financial resources. So they'll be going to schools with other children. There may be counseling available for them, but they will have probably some mental health issues. And then they also often have interrupted schooling because either the schools aren't functioning very well in the communities that they come from, or maybe they were pulled out because of gang-related activity or threats and it wasn't safe for them to go to school. So a lot of the children have had interruptions in their schooling, and that can make it difficult to teach them. It can make it difficult to prepare them. I mean, they come in usually ages 15 to 17 during the high school years. They have to get ready to take, you know, very demanding course loads, high-stakes graduation tests. So there's a lot of work for the schools to do in preparing these children. And then the other thing that sometimes happens is they don't have the documentation of their prior school enrollment. And so the schools don't really know how much formal education they've had. They don't know where to place them. They may even have trouble enrolling in school in the first place.
Alejandro, what kind of language skills do these kids mostly have when they show up in Maryland public schools?
Well, most of them are strictly Spanish-speaking. We do get a lot of children from Guatemala, and Spanish is not their first language. They may speak Mam or Quiche or some other language. And so that in itself is a big impediment to their education here.
And is that true, Randy Capps, is that true nationwide, that language is a problem for these kids getting into schools?
Well, yeah, they're predominantly Spanish-speaking children, and a lot of the areas, most of the areas where the large numbers go, Los Angeles, Houston, and Dallas, Texas, Miami, this area, New York City, Chicago, there are, you know, by either bilingual education or English as a second language courses, there are staff in the schools that can speak Spanish. So they, if Spanish is their primary language, they get a lot of support. But a lot of the Guatemalan children do speak these other less common languages, and support for those languages is harder to find.
So I want to make sure I'm clear from either one of you, though. Is there any particular federal pot of money that helps provide services for these kids in school? Is this entirely a local responsibility to meet the needs these kids show up with in school? Randy?
So the federal funding for low-income schools, it was just reauthorized by Congress as the Every Student Succeeds Act, the ESSA. does provide extra support to schools with large low-income populations and support for populations that have, you know, English is not their first language. And so, you know, the districts can be creative in using this money. There's not a lot of it, but it is allocated just like regular school district revenues to some degree based on the number of children in the school. So it's not that there isn't any federal funding. It's just it's not targeted specifically for these unaccompanied children. It's targeted for low-income and non-English-speaking children in general.
Thank you for clarifying that for me. That's Randy Capps from the Migration Policy Institute in Washington. Here on Midday, I'm Sheila Cast. Alejandra Morisi, staff attorney for Catholic Charities Esperanza Center in Baltimore, is here with me in the studio, and we're taking your calls at 410-662-8780. Alejandra, I didn't really ask you much about the family situation these kids find themselves in. Are most of them reunited with somebody whom we would consider part of their nuclear family, a parent or a sibling?
Yes, they are. Most of them are.
But this may be someone they haven't lived with for a long time.
Yes, and that's where I believe the challenges are. Sometimes they haven't seen their parents in over 10 years. They were left as babies in the home country, and then they're reuniting. And I think from both sides, you have a romantic idea of what the reunion will be like. But then they come here, and the parents have to deal with a kid who may be very traumatized, like Randy mentioned. And the child needs to get used to a whole new country, a new language, rules, everything. And so there's a lot, unfortunately, that presents so many challenges that sometimes there are like a lot of breakdowns in the family. And then that just has like an adverse effect on the children.
Give me an example without a name.
Well, sometimes you... And the fact that the children were so independent sometimes, or like there's a normalized violence also plays into this, because...
What do you mean by normalized violence?
I think a lot of children downplay the violence that they've experienced. And so that then they're not prioritizing things like mental health and taking care of those things. Neither are the parents. So you have children who come in here and... Let's say they didn't live in a structured household and they weren't going to school. So now they have to go to school and they're in a relationship and the parent says, like, you have to follow the rules here. And their first instinct might be to run and to run away from the household. And sometimes it's just trauma, how they're dealing with the experiences that they've had. And so then that presents a predicament for us when we're trying to represent the children, because we also want to make sure that the children are okay and in a stable environment.
So what kind of mental health services are these kids getting?
Well, we are working, the Esperanza Center works with a lot of programs that come out of Johns Hopkins, actually. Hmm. We work with the Kennedy Krieger Family Center, and then there's a new project for unaccompanied minors in which they're contacting the local schools and trying to receive referrals from there. And so we try to get children therapy, individualized therapy. There's also other centers that offer, that are starting some support groups for the children and for the families also, so that everybody can learn how to cope with the reunion better.
I mean, obviously it's something that Esperanza Center is seeing play out with differences because every family is different. But are there some lessons that have been learned in the last 2 years from the first surge? Is there some advice you can give families when the reunification is starting that seems to work, seems to head off some of the problems you saw 2 years ago?
You know, I think ideally it would be to get help, to get support, either with therapy or through a support group, in learning how to deal with the changes. I mean, I think that anybody would be very overwhelmed by that type of change if you've never lived with your child and all of a sudden you have a 15-year-old who's, you know, starts living with you. That's a big change for the parents as well as the minor. So I think that my advice would be to reach out and receive the mental help and support that's sometimes available.
And presumably is more likely to happen if you ask for it than if you just hope it materializes.
Yes. Even though in our practice, we tend to really refer. Culture plays a lot into this also. So mental health, like therapy services, are not really the first thought on a lot of our clients' mind. It's something that we introduce and we just like try to really encourage our clients to take on, because it's not... I just think culturally is sometimes it's not received well.
Randy, there are probably people listening to this conversation wondering what they can do to help. What would you say, from a national perspective, most needs to be done? Alejandra raised you raised the question earlier, I think, whether we'll have the resources we need. Is anybody working to increase the funding that goes into all these different aspects we've been talking about?
Well, I think that is a question, of course, that's going to be handled between, you know, Congress and the Obama administration. There were supplemental resources made available for the wave of unaccompanied children that came in during 2014. You know, Office of Refugee Resettlement is in a tight position because they've also got to continue resettling refugees in general, and the Obama administration has committed to take more of the regularly resettled refugees this year and next year as well. So I do think a lot of it has to do with coordination and targeting of the resources. You know, we understand a little bit better what some of the threats are now, and I think as unfortunate as it is, these cases that came to light this week in the congressional hearing really show that we just need to do a better job with the initial screening, with the background checks, with home visits.
You're keeping a closer eye on this nationally than I am. I tend to think of anything having to do with immigrants as sort of a toxic debate these days. Are you seeing a bipartisan concern about these young unaccompanied migrants?
Absolutely. It was a huge... I mean, that was evident at the hearing. I think that there's a huge concern for the well-being of these children. And people can disagree about what the policy should be, how open our doors should be, you know, in terms of people coming to the U.S., but once they get here, I think that there's a general agreement, especially if they're children, that they should be treated well and at least protected and given basic safety. The other thing I'd mention is that, you know, the majority of these children are going to the big cities, again, Los Angeles, Houston, this area, New York City, Miami, which are generally immigrant-friendly and which have a broad base of support, school districts that have a lot of experience working with Central American students, great group community groups that step up to the plate. I think, you know, what people can do is to get involved in these things, to help to volunteer at the schools or at some of these nonprofit organizations.
And let me give our last half minute to Alejandra to ask, if people want to help, we've talked about what lawyers can do, what would you suggest?
Well, we definitely cannot meet the demand without the help of volunteers and the attorneys that we have who are pro bono attorneys. You can volunteer also in other areas for us too. Translations, things like that, they're very, very useful. And then just offering admin help to us is would be.
And all of that at
you can go
Catholic
through our
Charities,
website. Yes.
Catholic Charities. -md.org. That's all the time we have for. I want to thank you both, Alejandro Morisi from Catholic Charities Esperanza Center in Baltimore, and Randy Capps from the Migration Policy Institute. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I also want to thank the DIS for supplying lunch today for Midday's guests. The DIS is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Features signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo crab cakes. The DIS is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on weekends on the web at thedisbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.